This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our next speaker today is Ms. Lisa Jackson, who served as administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the first Obama administration from 2009 to 2013. During her tenure as administrator, Ms. Jackson pledged to focus on core issues of protecting air and water quality, preventing exposure to toxic contamination in our communities, and reducing greenhouse gases. With all of EPA's efforts following the best science, adhering to the rule of law, and being implemented with unparalleled transparency, Ms. Jackson is the first African-American to serve as EPA administrator, and as some of you know, if you follow the Moth podcast, she tells a poignant story of her journey from the Ninth Ward of New Orleans to the highest levels of our nation's capital. At EPA, she made it a priority to focus on vulnerable groups, including children, the elderly, and low-income communities that are particularly susceptible to environmental and health threats. In addressing these and other issues, she promised all stakeholders a place at the decision-making table. Jackson is a summa cum laude graduate of Tulane University and earned a master's degree in chemical engineering from Princeton University. Ms. Jackson will be joined on stage in conversation with Professor David Sedlak. And David is he's the co-director of the Berkeley Water Center and also the co-chair of today's symposium. Professor Sedlak's research examines the fate of chemical contaminants in wastewater treatment plants, steroid hormones in the aquatic environment, and advanced technologies for treatment and reuse of wastewater. Please join me in welcoming Lisa Jackson to Berkeley.
So I'd like to ask you some questions today about your time at EPA and to see if you can give us some insight, especially with relationship to water and climate adaptation. And please feel free to take these questions in other directions that you think would be interesting to the audience. So I think I'll start and we'll see where it goes from there, and kick me if I'm going in the wrong directions. Okay. So the Clean Water Act is the primary regulatory authority that EPA has to deal with problems related to water. And it was conceived in a period before we really were thinking a lot about climate change and climate change adaptation. So do you think the Clean Water Act needs an overhaul, particularly with respect to climate change?
First off, hi to everybody from EPA. Don't raise your hands, because then you'll have to explain why you're here instead of talking to but hi to Berkeley as well. Thanks for having me. So Clean Water Act, let me think on that. We were talking about it outside a little bit, and I got some help from the EPA folks. The Clean Water Act in general had a specific set of goals, which were around water quality, access to water from the standpoint of recreation, but not necessarily water quantity. So some might say on first blush that it's not maybe the primary place in the federal government where these discussions should happen. That being said, EPA has done an amazing job, as usual, of thinking about adaptation issues for much, much longer than we've really started discussing them. We were talking, I think today the New York Times has an article saying that the president's adaptation plan is getting some amount of announcement today. We weren't sure the details, but the federal government started to talk about adaptation a lot. The president's climate plan that he announced in June talks about adaptation as well. So I think the Clean Water Act, first and foremost, if you're building infrastructure, which is a lot of what that act has spent most of the money on, needs to look at and plan for flooding or drought or a change in water quantity and intensity of water activities around the planning for capacity. That makes great sense. I think when you look at issues like stormwater, which the Clean Water Act addresses, as long as the Supreme Court allows it to, sadly, I think there the Clean Water Act has been arguably less able to deal with non-point source discharges as effectively, because they do tend to be local issues, very parochial. They require the kind of planning that we heard the mayor speak of so well, which is not just on a city level, but sometimes on a regional level, sometimes on a community level, to deal with issues around justice, to deal with issues around equity. And so I think those kinds of things, while EPA can and should give guidance on, the Clean Water Act would need to be revamped a bit if you want to really have EPA 100% in the game. Who else is in the game? The Corps of Engineers. And I used to tell them all the time that if, you know, the title is really the nation's engineers, how can the nation's engineers not have a full-throated, loud plan for how to deal with climate change effects in our nation? We don't have a place for that. And we suffer from the normal issue of infrastructure funding being funded somewhat at the national level through taxes and the distribution around transportation and the Clean Water Act and other and housing, but not being coordinated into a national infrastructure plan or climate plan.
Well, being more specific, the Comprehensive Environmental Restoration Plan for the Everglades was developed at a time before people really understood or fully appreciated the effects of climate change. So I know the National Academies given opinions on the effect of climate change on the Everglades restoration, and you've been involved in some of the discussions about the plan. How do you think that plan would look different if the regulatory authority to address climate change and climate adaptation was more explicitly included in the final planning process?
I think we could talk about any plan for a large ecosystem, but the Everglades is a good one because it is so large and it's been so well studied. And it is a place where the Corps of Engineers, for example, has real expertise. I feel like I'm ignoring this side of the room. I'm sorry about that.
I'll ignore them.
Okay, he's ignoring you. And let me just say for the record, one of the reasons I came to California was to lose the suits. I'm very disappointed in
One of the reasons we invited you is so we could put on the suits.
We wear jeans at Apple. It's nice, actually. I didn't bring them with me. I don't have them in the closet. This is as good as it gets, actually. We're talking about the Everglades and large ecosystem restoration. So there are many around the country, including Bay Delta and all kinds of ones that are much more local than the Everglades. And I think so the answer is the same for many of them. It's a matter of degree. Listen, you heard I'm from the Ninth Ward in New Orleans. And famously, after the hurricane there, there were right and good questions asked by planners and others who care deeply about the city, about what you do when a tragedy, a horrible tragedy, gives you not the opportunity but the mandate to rebuild and rethink, and how you do that in the context of the human element, which, you know, you can say is politics, but it's actually the way politics is supposed to work in a free democratic society, right? People have views, and they tend to be pretty parochial when it comes to where they live and how they live. And so I think the Everglades is a great example of that. In one hand, you would say this whole thing is about a couple of sectors, the agricultural sector, not a stranger to California, the development, real estate development sector, the need for drinking water for the city of Miami and other very well-developed areas in South Florida, which the experts know much better than I, and then the need for conservation, not just for wildlife, but of the actual way that water was managed by by Mother Nature in the lower half of that great peninsula, which is Florida, which is to have the movement of water fairly freely in and out and across that made for a very rich ecosystem, but also a very adaptable one. It is so much less adaptable now because of improvements that are not going to be wiped away whether you think they should or not. I mean, I'm enough of a pragmatist. People often point to me as sort of the green angel in the room, but people have to be taken into account. And I think what the plan would do is make at least some attempt to look forward and give leaders something else that you have to have in this process. Thankfully, LA certainly had one in you, Mayor. But you have to have leaders who are willing to stand up in front of those city councils and those moneyed interests and folks who are trying to primary you, as in the case of some places in our country, and say we have to look beyond the next 4 years. And that's really hard.
But it was an investment of many billions of dollars, and we think of those kinds of investments having staying power for 50 or 100 years. So I guess I'm curious about the uncertainties associated with the plan and how it will look not 10 or 20 years from now, but 50 or 100 years from now, and whether there was a lack of information that made it difficult to plan for that, or a lack of political will to address climate change adaptation in a straightforward way.
Well, you know, you'd probably want to have the folks who were around when the plans were being developed way back when, and I don't want to in any way denigrate them. The Everglades plan is about water quantity and water quality, and if either one of them don't fall within a certain range, you can't have the Everglades. So you can starve the Everglades by giving it too much water. I guess that's not starve. You can overfeed it. You can give it too little water, which is what tends to happen to it. And then if you give it water, just the right amount within the range, but it's the wrong quality, you have the exact same problem, too much phosphorus. So, yeah, I think if somebody could have looked way back when, and I think it was, you know, it was emblematic of our country's optimism that we would look at a big ecosystem like this with all the changes that had been made and said, we're going to save it. It's that iconic to us. Same thing's been done in the Mississippi River Delta in my hometown. Once you make that decision, you can question the initial decision, but I don't think you can turn that clock back. So I think you need to look at water flows and recognize the differences. You can make those changes. Mm-hmm. You could also look at the impact of development and continued development on whether you can ever break the cycle such that you really do get to a steady state. And I think that question's a hard one to answer, and I wouldn't pretend to know an answer.
Thank you for taking a shot. You humored me. So during your tenure at EPA, you were a real big advocate for green infrastructure, and I was particularly struck by the plan for addressing combined sewer overflows in Philadelphia by turning to green infrastructure instead of gray infrastructure. But what if it fails to deliver on the promise? Will a city like Philadelphia have to invest additional money in conventional systems of pollution control? And if they do, will this discourage future risk-taking in the future? And if they don't, will that just force people back into more gray infrastructure?
Yeah, I think it's really important when you think about sewage, water quality in large cities to look at what's really happening, not what ideally happens under the Clean Water Act, right? So every regulator has faced the moment where you have to send or enforce against a large city that honestly throws up their hands and says, okay, I have a city with a failing set of infrastructures. I don't have the tax base I used to do. My folks need any number of things, and the federal government is walking away from giving me the kind of funding I used to have. And we're not seeing a change in that pattern, and you want me to spend all my money on sewage and on projects that, by the way, are also incredibly unpopular because I got to rip up the streets and totally disrupt traffic, and people get angry at me on a street-by-street level, right? Fair enough. And, you know, I was an administrator when a lot of the big enforcement cases were brought. I think a lot of them were brought under Carol Browner. And there are tons of mayors who still don't have a great taste in their mouth about the EPA because they felt like we should be on the same side. We're both public entities trying to work for the betterment of our places. And yet I've been hit with this huge order with penalties. We had the same thing in Washington, D.C. And so then you get into the either or, which I don't think is a fair statement, which is either we go ahead and enforce this order against this public entity, which simply doesn't have the money, which just results in more orders that have more protracted schedules and some amount of penalty assigned to it in the interest of fairness, or we try something radically different. And, you can argue about how radical green infrastructure is, but I think it's pretty radical if it's done really well, if it's monitored, if it's measured, if it's designed to be more than just an excuse for not building something, but instead engages a community into real discussions on the sub-city level of how we're going to manage this water and how we're going to do it in a way that doesn't end up with raw sewage flowing into our river and our streams. And how are we going to do that without writing off this section of town, right, and not writing off maybe a more affluent section of town? One of my more fun projects was declaring the LA River navigable. And we did it. We did it. I said, listen, some people got famous for walking on water. You can do that in L.A. It's concrete water in L.A. But it had to be done. Why? Because you had to. I mean, there were some pretty courageous people who made a point of showing it was navigable. But the reason you did it was not just to honor what they did, but because the way the federal apparatchik works around funding and planning when it comes to the Corps of Engineers and EPA and others is that you have to look towards what the river can be, not what it is right now. You can start to think about adaptation plans that use what a river is supposed to be, which is a reservoir that and its banks and its watershed for water. So the answer to your question is, of course, there's a chance it won't work. And of course, there's a chance that it'll work, but not to the degree we'd like it to avoid the kind of gray infrastructure investments that need to be done. But I would submit to you that in many places, the alternative was it just wasn't going to be done, and we would just be in court still arguing over the gray infrastructure. Instead, I think we should salute leaders, mayors, like Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia as well, who said, you know what, let's try something different. Our people can't do it. And in D.C., a great, great, great effort there.
I want to change the direction a little bit and ask you a little about your time as EPA administrator. And I think one of the fascinating things that we didn't have in the introduction is that I think you were the first administrator who was trained as an engineer. Is that right?
I don't know.
Well,
most of them are lawyers.
Yeah, lawyers or politicians? No offense. So I'm kind of curious, how do you think your technical understanding of water and water pollution control affected the way you're able to do the job? And conversely, did your lack of a background in law or public policy or politics get in the way?
I think... this is because I have an 18-year-old who's, you know, freshman in college, not at this fine institution, at another big school in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I think engineering is a great profession because I think it teaches you how to solve problems. More important, I think it teaches you that the most important thing you do is state the problem, to really decide what it is you're trying to do, because how you state the problem is really going to determine your answer. Because any road will get you there if you're not careful. So I think it's great training. But I'll give you the advice I gave him, which is, you know, if it takes you a little longer to get that degree because you stop along the way and take some humanities that you just don't have time for, if that means that you learn some of the social sciences, which increasingly in issues of environmental protection, he's not into environmental protection, go figure. I mean, he is, but he's not majoring in environmental engineering or anything. Then that's good, because the way we're going to solve these problems is increasingly going to require understanding how people behave and why they behave the way they do and forming coalitions and working up from the grassroots. I do think the federal system is pretty broken in Washington. And so the closer you can get, whether that's an EPA regional office or a state government or a local government, is really helpful. So, yes, I thought being an engineer was a great aid. I think what you do in any case as a leader is you find out what you don't know and hopefully get really good people. So I had great lawyers. EPA has great lawyers, and I had great political appointees who served as counsel as well. And so it worked most of the time.
So when the next presidential nominee calls you and asks for advice about who they should appoint as the next administrator, would you recommend that they look among the ranks of the engineers and scientists instead of among the politicians and lawyers?
Yeah, of course. I would actually, you know, also remember I started at EPA in 1987 as a staff-level environmental scientist, and so that was the other huge advantage. I would recommend that they look amongst the extraordinary ranks of talented professionals who know what they're doing and who don't demagogue about issues but actually understand it. And I pale, like the mayor, I pale in comparison of an understanding of this issue. You know, in EPA, almost any issue that comes up, I'd be at an international meeting and somebody would bring up some esoteric issue I had never heard of. And I would go back to EPA and go, you'll never believe someone, and they'd be, oh yeah, we're working on that. And we would really be working on it, if not in our Office of Research and Development, maybe in a grant through Our STAR research program, maybe through some practice or a community-based grant, there's just incredible thinking. And, you know, despite all efforts by a lot of folks to discredit that agency, it's the caliber of the people that, and the fact that it's the only place in the federal government that's beholden to no issue except for the environment. There's no second agenda. There's only one at EPA. And I think that's why so many people spend so much time trying to discredit it.
Well, so David mentioned that that story that you told on the moth, and we all enjoyed it quite a bit. And in that story, which I'd recommend
terrifying
people...
Terrifying experience. It's like stand-up.
Well, you did well. I think that you talked about the importance of a career in public service, and in light of the recent furloughs and budget cuts and general hostility towards government service, could you still recommend a career in public service to the young people in the audience?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why?
'Cause the alternative would make for a bad answer on the tape. No, of course I can. Listen, I mean, things have changed. I do first think that, again, if there's any message here, some of the action, some of the energy, some of the work is happening at the local level. That's not to say don't, if and when your friendly federal agency or department is hiring, you don't think about lending your skills and talents. That's actually what makes the system go. The other, you know, news about Washington is that there's really smart people in Washington. They're not always the folks with the microphone. But they are, and they're sometimes the folks with the microphone. But that end of it is just one permutation. Until 2009, I was, you know, a career employee. Well, actually before that, because I went to the state of New Jersey for a while at a political level. But I think... what you learn. When I first started the government, somebody pulled me aside and said, listen, the thing about the government is that if you're good and you're smart and you really are willing to work and learn, you learn so much and are handed so much responsibility early on, because we're not levels deep as budget cuts continue to happen. And so I did. I had incredible experiences. I understood all kinds of issues in this country based on the training and I got at EPA. It's also a great place for women. I had two kids and got my first real promotion after having my second child. Never felt like I paid a fee for any kind of career fee for that. And as an African American, I mean, and if you heard the moth, my father worked for the Postal Service. It has historically been a place where people of color and emerging communities can come into their own on issues like the environment. So you can have Latinos and African Americans sitting in a room trying to figure out these issues for our communities. So yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't have to be EPA. Although that's good.
Well, there are a lot of other careers that people have where they serve the public interest, and I'm wondering if there are other places where someone might look for serving the environment, and in particular whether which ones you think have been most effective?
I think one of the issues is that we have to get past this idea that the only way you have public services if you have a public sector career. There are no white hats or dark hats in that battle. I'm now on the private sector side. And part of my thinking on that was I spent 25 years saying we didn't have to do this. We could figure out situations where we move together that needle. And now I'm at Apple. And I can tell you that it's a pretty extraordinary place to think about those issues because it has scale. It has the same kind of scale that the government has. Maybe, I won't say better or worse, but different because it's an international scale. I just was in Asia, happened to have the honor of having dinner with Ma Jun, who you'll hear from later today, extraordinary man, extraordinary work. But to be able to say to him, hey, what should I be thinking about? And then know that there's an organization behind me that might allow me to work on those issues is no different in some ways. I think you have to carry the public service ethic, which this generation of students clearly does. We've done a better job of that in this country, of thinking about activism in the person, not the position. And that's what you have to take with you. You serve the public by never forgetting that there's a world outside of whatever it is you're doing on an issue. And if you're called to the issue of the environment, you can't be that parochial. I mean, you can't just clean your little piece of air or this piece of water. The wind blows and the water flows downhill. So somebody's going to be uphill from you and downhill.
Great. So this morning, I think we tried to look at the press release from the White House, and the phone was too small to see it. But I think we both are aware of the climate change adaptation strategy, or the draft strategy, and it identified a number of ways in which climate change affects the agency's mission. And I'm curious, what, in your opinion, is the biggest risk to the EPA's ability to do its job with respect to water that will result from climate change?
What is the biggest risk to EPA's ability to do its job that will result from climate change? I mean, I think that one of the issues is the infrastructure cycle, right? I mean, we know how. Some of the oldest engineering and technical sort of expertise in the environmental field is sort of sanitation and sanitary engineers, right? And it's a profession that until relatively recently, I think one would argue, might also be one of the more staid pieces of what we do. Like when I think about air quality, I think about folks who are on the cutting edge of constantly looking at research on new pollutants and new technologies. When you generally think about water technology, drinking water, wastewater, you think about sort of the same things that we've been thinking about for a long time. So one of the things I would hear all the time if I went to a WEFTEC meeting or other trade groups was, we have great ideas of things we can do, but we can't get anybody to go first, to really embrace the idea of doing it on the scale that it would take to do it, say, at MWD or in any large, medium-scale municipality. Can you certify us, indemnify us, give us the ability to make a mistake? Give us the ability to be Philadelphia on issues of technology so that we can actually get our technology sold, commercialized, so we can get past the question everybody asks us, which is anybody else using this at scale? Because I'm not going to be the first, right? And so I think that's going to be a challenge for EPA in times of tough budgets. It's not really EPA's challenge. It's the industry's challenge and us as a society. And then I think, of course, sort of the old bugaboo of green versus non-green infrastructure, which is not just about water. It can be beaches in New Jersey, where I also spent some amazing time, or levees in New Orleans, and elevations and flood walls and sea walls and all that that means, and dealing with drought if you're in agricultural industry. So all this infrastructure around planning for adaptation is something that is hard to get that balance exactly right between doing it, being highly technical, not doing it, being green, if you will, and getting the measurement and the monitoring to know what you're really achieving on something that you want to change now, even though it changes over a long period of time.
I think those are good observations. So we tend to look inward when we think about the EPA, but I'm sure you had chances to meet with your counterparts in other countries. So,
I wasn't actually expecting that. It's a full service school. A lot of things happen to you here.
Thank you very much. Tell your son that when he's looking for graduate school. So you know, you've met people who are your counterparts in other countries, and you're aware of what goes on in other countries. So are there examples of environmental agencies in other countries or other countries that we should be looking towards when we think about climate change adaptation and water?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, that's a hard one, in actually, because you can point to the usual suspects in the Nordics or places or Amsterdam, you know, and the Netherlands. You can even point to large infrastructure projects in UK or other places. But I think some of the really interesting work happens in those places that are dealing with climate change while dealing with growth issues. And there, I'm not going to single out anyone because I think the challenge is the same for everyone, which is committed leaders who know what the right thing is to do, committed technical people in the same agencies that the EPA or other agencies are. Those same people are there. Like when you deal in China, you find incredible technical expertise within the ministries of environment or within the commission and NDRC. It's the ability to make major moves to make change and to do it within whatever political system exists and to do it with an eye on a 10, 20, 30-year horizon. So I actually think you could easily point to the folks who want to tell us what the right things are to do and are doing great science. So from the standpoint of that, there's great science happening. But I think some of the more interesting places are where people are desperately searching for win-wins because it means the difference between lifting 100 million people out of poverty or not. And so you know where those places are as well as I do. I think those places also tend to need the capacity of a partnership, that the kind of expertise like a Berkeley, UCal can bring. And also your students will enjoy those challenges much more as well.
So. I think that's a good note to end on, a very positive message for a tough topic. So please join me in thanking Lisa.
Our next two speakers are will be a very nice back-to-back. They're both people who've played a critical role in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and in the current assessment that has just been released this year. The first speaker is Dr. Bill Collins, and he's a professor in residence in the UC Berkeley Department of Earth and Planetary Science and head of the Climate Science Department at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. A leading climate modeling expert, his research is focused on the changes in the energy balance of the Earth system and the implications of these changes for the future of our climate. Prior to coming to Berkeley, Dr. Collins worked at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He's a lead author of IPCC Working Group 1, the Physical Sciences. He was also a member of our steering committee and has contributed widely to the dialogue on advancing interdisciplinary leadership on climate change on the Berkeley campus. Bill, thank you for being here.
David, thank you very much for that kind introduction, and I would also like to extend my thanks to the Philomathia Foundation for making these 2 days possible, and especially our public forum today. This is really a very timely topic for all of us to connect water, climate, and society. The IPCC is what it is. It's an intergovernmental panel on climate change, really commissioned by the UN to deal with the global problem. And so what I'm going to show you are global results. And so I'm going to show you primarily what the global implications of climate change are, as summarized by the Intergovernmental Panel Fifth Assessment Report. And I'm like any good academic, I have incorporated, I'm sorry to say, acronyms in my title. So pardon me. And there will be points in this talk when I'm going to have to sort of translate from IPCC to English. Please bear with me. If you have questions about that, please don't hesitate to use the cards that will be coming around. I'll do my best, but there are times when that translation won't be perfect. So it's a real honor to talk to you about this report. And the next speaker, this is done as sort of more or less as a relay race. And it's always set up that the Working Group 1 gets to come finish first. But the Working Group 2 and Working Group 3 will be completing their reports in spring of next year. Chris has been the co-chair of Working Group 2, and his report will be issued, I believe, in March of next year. So all these three reports will be released to the national and international community in very short order. And our report deals with basically the physics of climate change and its implications for our environment around us. And I wanted to start by showing you, just sort of illustrating this process a little bit. So there were and the picture in the upper right-hand corner shows you let's see if this laser pointer actually works. Actually, I'm not even going to use a laser pointer because I've had too much coffee this morning. my aim is not going to be particularly true. The picture in the upper right-hand corner shows you the 300 people who worked in Working Group 1 in Tasmania. And I'll come back to Tasmania in just a second. They made sure that we got racked up lots of frequent flyer miles as part of this process, and we had a huge carbon footprint. And my chapter, of which I was honored to be a part, is in the picture of us is in the lower right-hand corner. The cover of the report is shown in the middle, and then some of the implications for California are shown in the left-hand figure. So this panel is commissioned by the UN to assess the state of knowledge of climate science. We do not do research. Our goal is to look at the literature, look at the state of the science, apply a strobe light to it, and come up with what we know in the year 2013, and to refer back to what we knew previously to show what progress we've made, and also to illustrate where there are still major gaps. Those are our three major functions as part of this report. I mentioned Tasmania. We had a particularly hot and fiery setting for our last meeting. It was in Tasmania, which is just south of Australia. Australia that year had a record-breaking year. This is before the government switched to becoming extremely conservative, and so the new government is now denying the connection between the fires that are occurring right now and climate change. But at the time of our last report, they had a government that actually conceded the point and wrote a report called The Angry Summer of 2012 and 2013. The upper right-hand figure shows you fire danger across Australia, which peaked. They had to add a whole new set of colors to their temperature graphs to indicate how hot it was in Australia, colors they never had to use before. The picture in the lower right-hand corner is a cloud being formed by a fire over Tasmania. So they had pyrocumulus clouds forming during our meeting. And in fact, when we were flying home, it was 120 degrees Fahrenheit at the Sydney airport. There were fires on the tracks between the national, domestic and international terminals, which shut down the train system. And when we got on board the plane, the air conditioning system crashed three times because the air conditioning was trying to vent heat from a hot air conditioner into even a hotter atmosphere. And any of you know how refrigeration works know that that physics just won't go. So we were living the report here in our last meeting, quite dramatic. This is also, when we were wrapping up this report, climate change was also coming a little bit closer to home. Last year was the hottest year on record in the United States. The picture in the upper right-hand corner shows you which states, the ones that are in deep orange, ones that are the states that had the hottest temperature ever recorded in national records by the National Climate Data Center. So it's pretty much the center part of the country had record temperatures, 120 years in the making last year, completely unprecedented. So we know that the climate is changing. And the other theme behind the symposium is both the challenges and opportunities. I'm going to sort of present, I guess, the challenge side of this, which I would like to essentially summarize for you as follows. We have built our society over the last 10,000 years in a period of extraordinarily stable climate, and that has been tremendously beneficial to figuring out where the best places are to grow crops, where the best places are to put cities. And we have cities that have been around for literally thousands of years, places like Rome, London, cities that have grown up and have established and developed rich cultures, and those cities and those localities are now going to be challenged by the fact that the climate around them, that climate envelope that we've relied on to be so stable for 10,000 years, is changing. So I'm going to talk to you about the challenges that this poses from the standpoint of water, because that's the theme of our meeting this morning. So our climate is changing, and this picture sort of illustrates the various ways in which it's changing. And all of these, I should say, every single one of the arrows on this graph correspond to real data. So this figure is backstopped by an enormous amount of observations being collected from the ground, from the air, from ships, from space. So these arrows are not speculative. There are numerous data sources that essentially determine the sign and the magnitude of each one of these arrows. And the ones that I want to point out to you that are relevant to water, in particular, are that glacial volume is decreasing. There are a number of places around the world where glaciers and melt-off from glaciers form a primary source of water. Boulder, where I came from, gets a third of its water from the Arapaho Glacier. That glacier will not be there by the end of the century. This is also true of the Himalayas. The Himalayas, our glaciers are melting at a fairly rapid rate. That's going to pose potentially pose a supply for water much later, but will pose a water supply problem. Snow cover is decreasing. There are any number of changes that have been observed, and we know this is happening. So the question is, what does this mean for our water supplies? And one of the key things in order to understand the issue, the connection between climate change and water, is to understand how temperature and water are linked. We also know quite reliably that the planetary temperature is increasing. This shows you one of four different data sets that all agree. This one is from the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. That's what GIST stands for. And it shows you the change in the Earth's surface temperature over the, roughly the last 100 years. And everywhere where there's a plus means that the trend is highly statistically significant. And you can, and the warm colors in this picture indicate where it's increasing. And in case any of you need a sort of a handy back-of-the-envelope guide between converting between metric and everything I'm going to show you, I'm sorry to say, is in metric. This is an international report, after all. And most of the world has sort of moved on beyond English units. So in case any of you need a handy guide here, just multiply by 2 in order to get degrees Fahrenheit, roughly, in order to convert. So virtually all the planet has been heating, and in some places more than others, but you can see it, particularly at high latitudes, places like Alaska, Canada, and Russia. And, of course, you can't actually see Russia from Alaska, but in any case, they're all... They have heated by on the order of about 2 to 2.5 degrees centigrade, so on the order of about 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit. It's getting much warmer at high latitude. As the system gets warmer, its capacity to hold moisture increases. So the amount of moisture that the air can hold increases exponentially with increasing temperature, and the atmosphere is warming along with the surface. This is something that's been known for some time. And so because of this connection between temperature and water, there's a connection between the increased warming and the hydrological cycle on which we depend. And this is our cartoon of the Earth's current hydrological cycle, the way that someone like me would look at it, which is globally, typically. And this shows you the colors indicate the amount of rainfall every year in centimeters per year. Remember, for those of you who are kind of doing this in your head, 300 centimeters is roughly... equal to, let's see if I can, it's roughly a yard. So is that correct? No, it's a foot. One meter equals, boy, 1,000 centimeters equals a yard. So just in case you're keeping track, 300 centimeters equals a foot of rainfall. So purple equals a foot of rainfall. And what we see in this graph are bright orange colors indicating where there's a lot of rainfall, the major storm tracks, high precipitation along the equator. This is the pattern around which we have built, for example, we have a Mediterranean climate in California because we don't get, Seattle gets all the rain, or a lot of it, and we get less rain in California. We do get some from the Pineapple Express. This is the pattern that we're now seeing change dramatically around us. So the changes, so here's the pattern as it's existed now for millennia. Here's what's happening to it. So again, the arrows are showing you how this global pattern of movement of water is changing. The basic things I want to call out to you here are that the storm tracks in both the northern and southern hemisphere are moving toward the poles. And there are places which are dry that are going to get drier. And this sort of theme of the wet getting wetter, the dry getting drier, is going to come back over and over and over again. Climate change seems to be sort of amplifying and hardening this pattern that we have in the present-day climate. And here it is manifested in a way that's kind of slightly more obscure, but the upper picture is the one that's relevant. That's the trend in the amount of water in the atmosphere. Where it's blue, we're getting more water. Where it's orange, we're getting less. And you can see that where it was already kind of dry in these zones where the atmosphere is sinking in the Pacific Ocean, that it's getting even drier. And where it's moist, for example, right along the equator where there's a lot of water vapor, it's getting even moister. So these patterns are getting bigger with time. And that's having an impact on ocean salinity. That's the other implication of this particular figure. Now, this is one of those figures I would be remiss if I didn't show you the technical background. So some of these figures were designed for the technical summary or the summary for policymakers, and some of them were really the kind of the raw data. And I'm going to sort of skip between the stuff that's a little bit more slated toward ministries of environment and then people like well, technically cognizant people, and this is one of the graphs that's slated for technically cognizant people, so my apologies. And you can see that the annotation in the lower right-hand corner is the figure number from the report. Let me translate this graph into English. What it's saying is that in 100 years, the storm tracks will move by about 1,000 kilometers northward, which is about, you know, almost the length of California. That's what's happening. And that will move water, you know, way up the coast of California into Canada. That's what's, and we know this is happening. There's data on here, there are models in here, but the data is pretty unambiguous. That means that there's going to be a dry zone left on the southward side of the storm track. That also has big implications for water supplies. Okay, so how do we translate this information into projections? So climate models predict the Earth's future. And I'm one of the many people who've contributed to climate models around the world. There were 45 different climate models that contributed to the projections, and I'm now going to switch into the part of the talk that deals with the future. These models are quite capable. So this is water vapor from a model that I've been helping to construct at 25-kilometer resolution. So this is about the distance between, if I recall correctly, between Davis and Sacramento. And this model is now able to track hurricanes, and it actually gets quite reliable hurricane statistics if we were to compare against present-day climatology. In the interest of time, I'm not going to let this movie run, but the idea is that we have models that can really emulate nature, and we can test that assertion against observations of the present-day climate. We've also benefited from our proximity to the motherships. I was particularly pleased that Lisa Jackson has joined Apple, because we've benefited tremendously in California from being close to the heart of computing innovation really around the globe. And what's happened is that as the computing has sped up by a factor of a million over the last roughly 10 to 15 years, our models have been able to zoom in to greater and greater regional specificity. And this gets back to the point that we heard from the mayor earlier. Now, 110 kilometers is, you know, getting down to about the size of the greater LA basin. That's still not going to cut it as far as the projections that we need. If we want to look at the connection between local to global, we need to go to a model that can do the globe and do local all in the same system. And that model is coming soon. So we think that by the end of this decade, the beginning of the next, we will have computers that are capable of resolving the gradients of climate change down into the Bay of San Francisco, which is really quite a remarkable development and will be an important one for us to extend the capability that LA has pioneered across the state of California, across the American West, and in fact across the country. And so we look forward to being part of this pioneering exercise to kind of push the envelope and to be able to connect local to global climate change. That's going to be very important for all of us. Okay, so now I'm going to switch into the part of the talk that deals with the future. And again, I'm going to show you a few graphs that are a little moderately technical. So what is this graph telling us? On the left-hand side, it shows you scenarios for carbon dioxide. And it's expressed in terms of parts per million, which is probably an unfamiliar unit. We are currently at 400 parts per million of CO2. We started back when the steam engine was introduced at 270. Okay, so we've increased, and when I say we're quite confident that it's we, have increased CO2, more or less increased it by 50% over this time period, from 270 to 400. The scenarios here range from 360, which is sort of what some people are advocating for us to return to, all the way up to nearly 2,000 parts per million of CO2. Just to put in context what 750 parts per million, which is sort of the intermediate scenario, means, 750 parts per million equals a level of CO2 that the planet has not experienced for 34 million years. 750 was what we had when the Antarctic ice sheet began to form 34 million years ago. So we've managed in 300 years to reproduce 30 million years of changes in carbon dioxide. We've basically punched the accelerator in kind of the worst possible way to go back in time. And this is, I think, as it has become evident, perhaps not the brightest thing we've decided to do. So the other thing that this graph makes clear is if you look on the right-hand side, that the CO2 concentrations map directly onto increased temperatures. The higher the CO2 level, the higher the temperature change. And this, again, is expressed in degrees Celsius. You might think, oh, geez, 4 degrees Celsius. I mean, that if I went to graduate school in Chicago, and believe me, that's the difference between, you know, morning and afternoon, and not such a big deal. And does make a big deal when you start applying this stress very rapidly to ecosystems, as we'll hear about from our next speaker. And when you look at how this pattern lays itself out over the globe, this relatively bland-looking change is actually a very big game changer. So the warming, as I indicated earlier, alters moisture and rainfall. So the warmer the atmosphere, we get enhanced moisture, weaker circulation, more rain. And I'm going to show you now this cartoon is translated, I'm sorry to say, in a couple of graphs that follow that are moderately technical. But this correlation between higher temperature and higher moisture is backstopped by observations and by models, and that's what I'm going to show you next. The connection between higher temperatures and higher rainfall is what I'm going to show you in two slides. So brace yourself, but here's more of these kind of wonkish figures. So this lays out, the only thing you should take away from this figure is the correlation between temperature on the horizontal axis and moisture on the vertical. And you'll notice that it's a dead straight line. The observations are on the lower left-hand end of this graph because that's where we are currently. If you allow the climate to warm, you march straight up that line to a much moister climate. That moisture, however, is going to be unevenly distributed, as you'll see in a second. A lot of it's going to reside over the ocean. The land atmosphere will actually get, the relative humidity is probably going to drop over land around most of the globe for a variety of reasons. Correlation between temperature and rainfall, right here. Look at the lower graph. The higher the temperature on the horizontal axis, the more rainfall on the vertical axis. Again, the models support this assertion of connection beautifully. And it's backstopped again by observations from the present day. Okay, so what does this mean for the hydrological cycle? So this is and the hydrological cycle is the jargon that climate scientists like myself use to refer to the motion of water through the climate system. So this is the transfer of water by evaporation from ocean and land into the atmosphere, its circulation, its formation of clouds, the formation of rainfall, and the return of that water from the atmosphere back to the land into the ocean. It's a cycle that's being driven by the input of solar energy that drives the evaporation. And so we refer to a hydrological cycle as referring to all of these processes connected together as one seamless system. Look at the precipitation graph on the top. This is the change in precipitation that we anticipate by the end of the 21st century following one of the more aggressive emissions scenarios. And again, the colors are here to sort of guide your eye. Brown colors indicate where it's going to get drier. Blue indicates where it's going to get wetter. And what you'll notice is that there's going to be a dramatic increase in rainfall over, for example, portions of the tropical Pacific where it's already quite moist. There are also places where it'll get appreciably drier. And so let me call your attention, for example, to the entire Gulf of Mexico, to Brazil, which has one of the most important rainforests on the planet that serves as a major sink for carbon dioxide. This drying is going to amplify an existing tendency for the eastern part of Brazil to already be quite hot and dry, and that pattern will be amplified by climate change. It's hard to tell, but the southwestern United States is also getting drier under this scenario. And there are portions of Africa that will also get appreciably drier, adding to existing stress, for example, that's already been plaguing the Sahel and elsewhere, as we'll hear about later on in this symposium. These changes in rainfall, and they're expressed in millimeters per day, and just so you have a handy guide to do the translation, they're roughly 3 millimeters per day of rainfall that fall around the planet. So this is actually a pretty big, some of these changes are quite large relative to that normal amount of rainfall that falls. This is a major and what appears to be nearly permanent shift in the climate. The other thing that's unique about climate change relative to something like an air quality issue, where a simple rain event will clear out the smog. Of course, it comes back again because people get in their cars, but the rain will clear the smog out. These greenhouse gases that are driving this change have lifetimes of, in some cases, centuries in the Earth's atmosphere. So this is not a problem even if we were to stop emitting tomorrow, we've already set the climate on a course of change. And that change will continue even if we were to dramatically ramp back our emissions. However, the sooner we ramp back, the we can avoid a scenario that looks like this. This is a pretty serious scenario in terms of changes to the water cycle. Relative humidity, as I indicated earlier, the ocean regions get a lot moistier, dramatic drops in relative humidity over land surfaces. Snow will decrease as well. This is showing you the percentage change, and I want to come back to this in a moment in connection with California, because this is a big deal for California. But global snow extent under the most, and so the lines in the upper graph go from the blue is the least dramatic emission scenario, the red is the most dramatic emission scenario. Under red emission scenarios, we lose 25% of the snow cover on the planet, putting greater stress on plants and certainly a greater stress on places like California that rely on time-release water from snowpack. Frequency of extremes will increase, and this was also going to pose a challenge for us because you may remember what happened when we had the Pineapple Express last December, flooding, landslides, etc. Those are slated to increase for California by about the frequency will increase by a factor of 3 by the end of the century, those kind of extreme Pineapple Express events. So we're seeing, and the mayor mentioned the heat waves that are going to begin occurring across the LA Basin and also in the eastern part of California. Again, these arrows correspond to patterns that are already manifest in the data. In some cases with less confidence than others, but these climate change is going to sort of amplify these changes that we're already measuring, already seeing in the climate record. And I will just show you, I've been sort of hitting on this theme for a while, but the wet gets wetter, dry gets drier, sort of amplifies, so more extremes. And the frequency between these extremes is also going to change dramatically. This is, again, one of these, this is supposed to be a sort of a public-friendly figure, but I don't think it is in my book. It's got like at least 3 different acronyms in the title. But the point of this figure is that extreme rainfall events that would normally would have been spaced 20 years apart, that spacing will shrink or collapse under climate change. So, for example, everywhere where it's deep blue, events that used to take 20 years will now take 2 years. They'll come back every 2 years. So if something causes a flood every 20 years, hey, it's back every second year. And remember what happened to New Hampshire. They lost bridges that had been in place for 200 to 300 years when they had that really strong rainfall event a couple of years ago. That's going to become the norm under extreme climate change. What this means for California is to get back to the issue of water supplies and bring this a little bit back closer to home, is a loss of the snowpack that we relied on as our time-release mechanism for water. And so let me explain to you what this graph shows. There are sort of 4 panels. The left 2 panels show you the change between sort of from now up to the mid-century. And then within that time period, there are 2 panels again, one showing you the effect of lower and higher emissions. In this case, higher emissions is actually lowballing what we're currently doing. So this was done, this figure was prepared for California by the California Energy Commission, and some of the authors of this report are in the room today. This was based on some older emission scenarios. The current emissions patterns actually exceed the high emissions figures that are shown on here. But we'll be down by 60% under business as usual by the year 2050, and down to 10% of our snowpack roughly by the end of the century. And that has big implications for what we do with our water infrastructure, which we need to begin dealing with. And again, it's potentially a solvable problem because California may actually get more total precipitation in a warmer, moister climate. It's just going to be falling as rain, not as snow. We're very confident in this result. We're not sure how much rain is going to be falling, but we're sure it's not going to be falling as snow. Okay. So with that, I would like to sort of conclude with some statements that are from the technical summary. This is sort of a distillation of the IPCC Working Group 1 report. And by the way, you can find this report very easily by just Googling IPCC AR5. All the details I've shown you are online now in electronic form. But I wanted to connect, you know, the challenges for future water resources, and we're going to hear a lot more about that from Chris in just a moment, you know, backstopped by the data and the evidence coming out of what we can already see in the climate system. And this is, so we have built our world around water that's very inexpensive. It's almost certainly underpriced. It appears all around us in our natural environment, which is one of the reasons why we enjoy California so much, in our water supplies that we use for agriculture, for drinking, in the natural beauty of some place like Monterey Bay. All of these resources rely on water. And what we're certain of now, as evidenced in the IPCC report, is that that world of water in which we're embedded is going to change. And so it's that challenge that faces us now which we must address. And I think we're now going to hear from the next speaker about the potential impacts of these changes. And then the symposium is really dedicated to the idea of, great, so we face a problem. Getting back to what we heard from Lisa Jackson, we have a challenge. What do we do about it? And so I am confident that we can address this challenge, but we sure as heck need to face up to the fact that it exists. So with that, let me conclude, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Bill. One of the great things about having Bill on our committee is that he's a great optimist. It's just none of us could ever figure out why. Before I introduce our next speaker, just to reiterate, we've passed around some cards, file cards, and we can continue to pass them around. Raise your hand if you didn't get one. And if you will have we'll have a question and answer period with both Bill Collins and Chris Field after the next talk, and you can submit questions then. So our next speaker is Dr. Chris Field. Dr. Field is the founding director of the Carnegie Institution for Science, the Department of Global Ecology. He's professor of biology and environmental earth system science at Stanford University and the faculty director of Stanford's Jasper Ridge Biological Preserve, and that's a site that has been a very important site in global climate change research. Dr. Field's research emphasizes the impacts of climate change from the molecular to the global scale. His work includes major field experiments on responses of California grassland to multi-factor global change, integrative studies of the global carbon cycle, and assessments of impacts of climate change on agriculture. He was a coordinating lead author for the fourth assessment report of the IPCC, and in September 2008, he was elected co-chair of Working Group 2 of the IPCC for the current assessment and is leading Working Group 2 on the impacts on climate change impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. Chris, thank you very much for being here.
Somebody can help. You know, it's really exciting to have an opportunity to speak in a session that started out with really inspirational comments from Mayor Villaraigosa and Administrator Jackson. I think where we are in the arc of the science and policy dimensions of climate change is a genuine, sharp need for effective communication between the science end and the implementation end, and the visionary leadership of people like Mayor Villaraigosa and Administrator Jackson is really critical for advancing that. But smart, effective work on the part of the scientific community has to be a counterpoint. What I'd like to do is talk about the way the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, tries to bring the science information to the point that it can be usefully addressed within the policy context. And I'm going to talk about 2.5 reports. I'm going to talk about the 2012 special report on the role of extremes, which are critically central to the whole issue of water resources, especially in California. I'll say a couple of things about the Working Group 1 report that Bill just told you about, and I will provide. IPCC has this kind of weird secrecy associated with the reports before release, so I can't tell you very much about the Working Group 2 report, but I will give a couple of hints. One of the things I will tell you is that's not the cover. We sampled hundreds of images as possible cover images, but one of the things that's striking about the climate adaptation agenda is that most climate adaptation work is people sitting around looking at PowerPoints, which is really boring, and it's really difficult to try and figure out how to communicate what the adaptation agenda looks like in a picture or two. And the what I want to do is more or less present a word portrait. Let me just say a few more things about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You've already heard a lot about it, and many of you are contributors. For those of you who have contributed either as authors or reviewers, thank you. You've made a big difference for the world. I think of the IPCC as a really unique partnership between the world's governments and the scientific community. The governments basically said, scientific community, if you'll follow our rules, we'll consider your assessments to be the definitive statement of what we know and what we don't know about the science of climate change. And the rules are complicated, and they involve lots and lots of steps, including for the summaries for policymakers, the source of many of the comments you saw from Bill, word-by-word consensus approval by all the world's governments. So that means that there's this incredibly high bar of recognition that whatever's in the SPM really has gone through a scrub and have been approved by every country word by word. I want to step back and just go through that one more time. If we're in a plenary approval session and I say warming in the climate system is unequivocal, I put that up on the whiteboard, and we don't leave that statement until, you know, you if you're Saudi Arabia or you if you're India or you if you're Angola agree that that's an accurate assessment of what the science on the climate change says. And a lot of that, the reason that that's important is illustrated by this October 18th cover of The Economist. I should say, by the way, that none of the examples of how science went wrong came from Berkeley or from Stanford. But still, there are lots of examples of science being a process that is amazingly powerful in its ability to self-correct. It's not amazingly powerful in its ability to get things right the first time. And as a consequence, what you really need if you want to ingest science into the policy process, into support for good decisions, is ways for serious bodies to consider what science results have stood the test of time, which ones are useful for transfer to the policy process. And that's what's unique about the IPCC. There are other efforts that provide comparable kinds of value. The committees of the U.S. National Research National Research Council, and at the state level, we've had some wonderful reports in California. But it's really important to have this vetting of science and ask, what are the things that are really standing the test of time? What's working? And I should say probably the best indicator of the effectiveness of the IPCC comes from the old adage that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And off in the lower right-hand corner is a pseudoscience report from one of the skeptical organizations that is configured to look almost exactly like an IPCC report, showing how much they, I guess as well, respect the contributions of the IPCC. A lot of the work of the IPCC historically, this is kind of the arc of the certainty about a discernible human fingerprint on global temperatures. And you can see in the first report in 1990, they really thought it would be a decade or more until we knew. And then beginning in the 2001 report, the confidence in the contribution of human emissions greenhouse gases to global average temperatures has gone up and up until now. There's just the slightest sliver of a possibility that the majority of the changes we've seen have not been due to human actions. But when we think about the application of this to the policy process, we really need to transition away from this very robust scientific foundation that Bill described to thinking much more about this as a problem in managing risks. And that's really what I want to focus on today. We in the IPCC made our most serious investment in the broad challenge of risk management in the 2012 Special Report on Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation, where we really explored not only the way that climate change contributes to changes in extremes, but the way those play out in risks of disasters, losses for societies, people, and ecosystems. Let me say just a few words about the general topic of risk. You know, for any kind of an outcome, temperature, precipitation, winds. There's some kind of a probability distribution. And as we move toward the right-hand end, especially of a temperature distribution, we typically have a set of consequences that are getting more and more serious as you go to higher and higher temperatures. So if you think about a probability of, let's say, high temperatures and plot the consequences on it, most generally it looks something like this. And in general, in terms of the impacts, it's useful to think about risk as something like a product between the probability and the consequence. So if you just take the product of these two curves, you get the green curve in the upper right panel there, and you can see that it's shifted to the right toward higher temperatures, and with lower probability events being the ones that are of greatest concern. And in general, that's what we see in the climate space, is that in order to make good decisions, we need to know not only about the most likely outcomes, but we need to know about the full range of possible outcomes, including relatively low probability, high consequence kinds of events. One of the implications of thinking of risk as this product of probability and consequence is that the motivation for action doesn't necessarily get stronger as you learn more. And in fact, if you look at an example like this, where the probability is smushed out potentially as a consequence of not understanding the background as well, what you see is with the same trajectory for consequence, the risk skyrockets as a consequence of having less confidence about the underlying science. So from a risk management perspective, actually, the situations we know the least about are in many cases the ones where we should be making the most serious investments. In the 2007 IPCC report, there was a conclusion that a changing climate leads to changes in extreme weather and climate events. And the way I think about it is that most of the impacts of climate, whether it's climate change or climate variability, really occur in the extremes. I think of weather and climate extremes as kind of the sharp end of the climate system, and whether the climate's changed or not, that's where things tend to break. Just to graphically present the 2007 conclusion, it's clear that it doesn't take a very big shift in the mean of something like this this temperature distribution, this is a hypothetical temperature distribution, to lead to a big increase in the number of hot events and a big decrease in the number of cold events. And when we think about where we're experiencing climate impacts, whether they're in heat waves and hot days, whether they're in heavy precipitation or droughts, and those are the things that we've seen in the recent observations, it's clear that's where the damages have piled up. And so I want to, in the rest of today's comments, kind of think through the issues about how the understanding of the kinds of changes we're observing really play out into the broad agenda of how we should be adapting to a changing climate. One of the things that surprised me the most when we started working on this special report on extremes, which, by the way, was a wonderful collaboration between Working Group 1 of the IPCC, the physical climate folks, and Working Group 2, the people who focus on impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability, was the understanding that disasters aren't natural things. Disasters are social constructs that really reflect the interaction between some kind of a triggering event. It could be a really severe event. It could be a modest event. And social conditions that are consistent with that penetrating into the scale of a disaster. And those social conditions involve vulnerability, the propensity to be harmed, a lack of resilience, and exposure, having assets that are in harm's way. In the IPCC report, the way we think about the overlap and the interaction between these three is that disaster risk really emerges from the overlap between weather and climate events, vulnerability and exposure. And when you think about the solution space, you could think about action on all three arms of that propeller. And of course, this is embedded in a much broader context. It's got forcing from both natural variability in the climate system and anthropogenic climate on the kinds of events that occur, and the issues of vulnerability and exposure are very deeply embedded in a social context, and especially a social context that has a big component of development going along with it. Of course, you can't understand the full set of interactions unless you look at the dynamics, and the dynamics include important feedback such that the realization of disaster risk often feeds back on development, typically in a very negative way, but both Mayor Villaricosa and Administrator Jackson talked about ways that inspiration from the realization of disaster can be positive. And, of course, as we think about development, we have an important control over greenhouse gas emissions that in the long run modulate the amount of anthropogenic climate change that we see that we have to deal with and that feeds back into this realization of disasters. It's important to understand that even though the science of climate change has advanced tremendously and the projections are getting better and better, there's still a substantial amount of uncertainty. And what I'm showing across the top is from the Working Group 1 report, the uncertainty due to climate model variability for end-of-century temperatures for sometimes it's characterized as a middle-of-the-road scenario, but this is a very low-forcing scenario. And this, the variation between 25% of the models are lower than the results on the left-hand side, 25% are higher than the results on the right-hand side. This is a small amount of variability relative to the difference between a low emissions and a high emissions trajectory. But it's important. And so for these end-of-century numbers, these are from wintertime. You can see for California, we're looking at a warming between 1 and 2 C on the lowest end of the variability and more than 3 C on the highest end, consequential. And when you look at precipitation, these numbers get to be even more daunting. And this is exactly the same thing with precipitation shown in percent change from present with the areas that don't have the crosshatching being significant changes. And what you can see is that for some areas, if you contrast the 25% and 75% of the model space, the 25% has drying in South America and the 75% has a wetter South America. So when we think about making good decisions about climate change, it's not just reading out the prescription from the climate model and saying, okay, now we know what to do. Let me illustrate this even more clearly with another viewpoint on the precipitation perspective. So this is for RCP 8.5, the highest of the scenarios that's been considered in the most recent round of IPCC. I think of RCP 8.5 as very much business as usual. In fact, over the last 10 years or so since these scenarios were constructed, actual emissions have run slightly above RCP 8.5. 8.5 corresponds to the end-of-century radiative forcing in watts per square meter from the extra greenhouse gases. And in this representation, the brown colors are drying, the blue colors are wetter, and this map has something that you haven't seen in previous maps, which is gray areas. Gray areas are ones where the large majority of the climate models say we will have changes in precipitation outside the background variability. We'll have significant changes in precipitation, but the models don't agree on the sign. Some say significant increases, some say significant decreases. The classic problem in risk management. We don't know whether the right answer is to build a dam or to tear down a dam, but what we know is that we need to put a lot more emphasis on finding ways to have a sustainably crafted water system and one that can deal with a range of variability in the future. And I think if there's a single important lesson in the adaptation area, it's that acknowledging this kind of variability is going to be really important. Even where the climate changes are known with a high level of certainty, by the time they penetrate into societal changes, it's the variability that becomes key. You know, throughout the history of climate science, there's often been this sense that there was a tension between investments in adaptation, coping with the climate changes that can't be avoided, and investments in mitigation, reducing the amount of climate change that occurs and protecting ecosystems and societies. I think we've now finally advanced beyond that, and we've advanced beyond it for two critical reasons. One reason is we understand that the kinds of investments that can advance both climate adaptation and mitigation typically do occur together and, in fact, work better when they occur together. But it's also important to recognize that they play out in different parts of the coming decades. And in particular, if you look at, this is the contrast between the temperature trajectory for the highest and lowest scenarios that were explored by the IPCC. And you can see there's dramatic changes in temperature at the end of the century. But if you look out in the period a little bit before 2050, I'll draw a band over the 2030 to 2040 time period, you really see something where the scenarios haven't diverged much. Lots of warming, a much different world, but you need to think about this as an era of near-term committed climate changes. I like to think of it as an era of climate responsibility where we just have to acknowledge that we have a world that's changed dramatically. This is a period where investments in mitigation are going to make a big difference in future decades, but they haven't yet begun to make a difference, and the lowest and the highest scenarios have essentially the same temperature outcomes during this period. Then, of course, by the time we get to the end of the century, we're looking at an era of climate options where the consequences of being in the blue world and the red world there are dramatically different, and I'll come back to that at the end. But what I really want to do over the next couple of minutes is talk about a map, and this is a map of what I consider to be the solution space. I showed you in the overlap between events, vulnerability, and exposure, what you might think of as the map of the problem space. And we now have the opportunity to say, okay, what do we need to do in order to fix it? And the solution space has a bunch of components, and they interact in diverse and complicated ways. But I think we're finally getting our arms around the kinds of investments that are practical. We're far from getting our arms politically around the kinds of the commitment to make the full range of investments that need to be made. Before talking about the details of the solution space, I want to say just a couple more things about the way that climate extremes play out in terms of being converted to disasters. Sometimes you get a huge event, a gigantic heat wave or a gigantic drought that leads to a disaster. But often disasters play out as a consequence of a relatively modest climate event or sometimes a series of modest events that just hit at the wrong time or the wrong place or a society that's fundamentally unprepared. Here's one example that was played out in the IPCC special report, and it's a really important reminder that investments in building resilient communities can make a huge contribution to protection from extreme events. It's also important to understand that the impacts of climate change play out in very different ways in different parts of the world. You know, we tend to think about hot spots of vulnerability where people are poor or lack good infrastructure. But when I look across the global landscape of impacts, the main thing I see is that every place is vulnerable, but the kind of impacts are different. What you see is gigantic economic losses in the world's developed countries, and you see existential losses in developing countries. And the staggering reality is that in the past 40 years or so, 95% of the fatalities that are associated with climate-related events have come in developing regions. And recognizing that there's no single metric that characterizes vulnerability and that the kinds of solutions that are required are very different depending on what infrastructure is a really key starting point. So as a consequence, I want to talk about how you think about dealing with the adaptation agenda, mainly as an exercise in finding the right starting point, opening out the agenda, and then figuring out what can be done. And here's one example that we've already heard about, the massive loss of life that was associated with the 2003 heat wave in Central Europe. And and we know a lot about the climate occurrence, the extent to which climate change amplified the probability of that event. We know that we're headed for a future with much higher frequency of this, but we also know there are a whole bunch of factors that contribute to risk, and that it wasn't everybody who suffered an equal risk of extreme outcomes in this event. And we also know that there are a whole bunch of kinds of solutions that could be put in place on the right side of this image that can really dramatically decrease the risk of loss of life during this kind of event. And those played out to a very positive consequence in the 2005 heat wave in Europe, which was actually very similar to the 2003 event. So let me run through some elements of this map of the solution space that reflect the kind of consolidated experience of the global community as reflected in the 2012 IPCC report. The first key finding is that there really are no single bullet solutions, silver bullet solutions that solve the climate adaptation problem. The things that work best are investing in a portfolio of actions, recognizing their different vulnerabilities in different places and different needs and different success expectations from different kinds of investments. When we're thinking about extreme events, it's important to have effective communication, to reduce the risk of extremes, and then to be able to transfer the risk and respond to the risk as it occurs. Second, it's really important to recognize that we face a world with lots of different kinds of risks. Some are related to climate change, some are related to human security, some are related to the global economic system, and that investments in adaptation that address more than one hazard at a time are almost always better in terms of cost-benefit ratio than investments that only focus on a single kind of risk. A third key conclusion is that there's no single scale of actors. We heard a lot about what we can hope to see accomplished in cities, and there are wonderful opportunities, and there's been wonderful leadership at the scale of cities. But there are other kinds of decisions that work best at the scale of a family or a firm, other kinds of decisions that work best at the scale of a national government or an international organization. And that trying to solve the entire problem with investments at one level only is much less efficient than recognizing the benefits of linking from local to global scales. And then finally, it's important to recognize when we think about the adaptation agenda, even though there's a lot we know, there's a lot we don't know, and that effective decision-making really requires an iterative approach where we take steps, learn from those steps, go back to the drawing board, and then take next steps. You know, the way I think about the adaptation most broadly is that we're trying to address two big parts of the time and space scale. We're trying to find steps that decrease short-term risk while building long-term resilience. And at least for me, the thing that is most critical about that is to recognize that there are three parts of the global development agenda that we typically think of as three distinct things that are really different aspects of one thing: disaster risk reduction, climate change adaptation, and sustainable development are all really different sides of the same coin, and until we can merge those, we're not going to make the kind of smart decisions that the world needs. Finally, I want to leave you with what's probably the most important part of the adaptation agenda, and it's not about adaptation. If we go back to the map of the problem space, I had a subtle arrow across the bottom here associated with greenhouse gas emissions. And I want to leave you with the image of the global temperature map at the end of the century for an aggressive mitigation scenario and a business as usual scenario. The top picture is going to take heroic efforts in order to produce a world that warms only 1.5 to 2 C. Business as usual results in a world where the global average temperature has increased about just a smidgen less than 4C in these simulations, but with almost all the land areas increasing by much more than that, and the high latitudes increasing by unimaginable 8, 9, 10, 11 C. We can't solve the adaptation challenge in the bottom world. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.